For thousands of years, people have asked the question, what is truth? And even now, thousands of years later, I'm not so sure we're any closer to the answer, at least the way many people understand it. In fact, though, in the 20th century, though, many people believe, or even before that, that science is the key to understanding truth. That's a compelling thought, but I'm not so sure it's as simple as that. That's what I want to talk about today on the show.
The fact is, I have very logical reasons for believing in things that logic and reason cannot teach me. It's kind of ironic, but the more complexity science finds in life, the more unlikely becomes the whole scenario and theory they use to explain the origins of life. The amazing thing that quantum physics shows is that nature, at its most fundamental level, strains human credulity and belief in ways that biblical faith never does.
Hi, Cliff Goldstein here, and welcome. I want to start out by referring to a book that I've mentioned on here before, Joseph Conrad's novel, The Secret Agent. Though really a study about the nature of human evil, the novel touches on numerous other topics as well. It was about these radical revolutionaries, terrorists if you may, living in London, and they were planning a bombing. They wanted to incite fear in the nation in hopes that it would lead to destabilization and to eventually a revolution. Now, what was interesting was some of the dialogue and thinking in the story. The bomber was told that he needed to blow up the Greenwich Observatory, you know, that of Greenwich Mean Time, first established by Charles II, I think in the 1600s, and has played a leading role in navigation and astronomy. Now, why they picked this target is very interesting. Because, see, in their thinking, science had become the preeminent mode of knowledge. It was the foundation of their society now that, and this was in the late 1800s, early 1900s, now that religion had apparently taken a back seat. Now, talking about the Londoners, one of the leaders says the following, and this is very interesting. Talking about the citizens, they believe that in some mysterious way, science is the source of their material prosperity. They do, and the absurd ferocity of such a demonstration will affect them more profoundly than the mangling of a whole street or theater full of their own kind. To the last, they can always say, oh, it was mere class hate. But what is one to say to an act of destructive ferocity so absurd as to be incomprehensible, inexplicable, almost unthinkable, in fact, mad? Attacking science? Why, they are attacking the foundations of society itself at its core. And then he goes on to say what I consider a great line, one of those things I wish as a writer that I would have written. But I love this. I love this line. He says, since bombs are your means of expression, it would be really telling if one could throw a bomb into pure mathematics. Oh, I love that. Throw a bomb into pure mathematics. What a great image. What a great metaphor. I mean, how much more foundational can you get than, you know, that can you get in the material world than at the level of pure mathematics? I mean, you're almost even below pure foundations there, pure materialism. Anyway, of course, they know they can't, you know, throw a bomb in mathematics, so they want to go at the deepest level they could, and that was science, and that was symbolized by the Greenwich Observatory. Now, what's interesting, too, was because this book was written pre-World War I, it was a time when humans still had great hope for what science and progress and reason were going to do for humanity. Of course, today, attitudes have somewhat changed regarding the great hope that people once placed in science. I mean, despite all the good that science has done and is still doing, I mean, it's become pretty scary as well. I mean, hasn't it? Sure, we have to live with earthquake, floods, tsunamis, and so forth, but unless you're living in a vulnerable area, my guess is that most of us are more fearful of what humanity, using the tools of science, might do to us. Yes, there's no question, science has become kind of a two-edged sword. And yet at the same time, as I've said before on this program, we live in a very scientific age. We are immersed into a scientific culture, and to a great deal, science is king. And again, that's understandable. I mean, my goodness, look at all the good that science has accomplished over the years. It's incredible. I marvel at things like my iPhone. You know, I remember a while back, I was in a restaurant in downtown Jerusalem, and they wouldn't take a credit card. So I knew I was going to have to get some money from an ATM machine. So here I am. I'm sitting in an Ethiopian restaurant in downtown Jerusalem. I pull out my iPhone, this tiny little thing, get online, boom, 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 transfer the money, and voila. When I go to the ATM the next day, the money is there. I mean, talk about the marvels of science. It's unbelievable. I still, you know, in the age of the internet, I'm still amazed that I could do something like that. 150 years ago, something like that would have seemed like magic or a supernatural manifestation, a miracle even. No question. Science is amazing. So amazing, in fact, that as I've said before in here, that for many people, science has become kind of the absolute arbiter of what is true, of what is knowable. For many people, science is the ultimate source of truth. Unless it can be proven scientifically, unless it has some sort of science to back it up, then it's not something that can be taken seriously. It doesn't have a high epistemic status. It might be true, it might be right, it might be good, but without science, you know, without something of a scientific framework to back it up, for many people, there's no way of verifying it in any credible manner. Now, there has been some backlash to this idea centuries ago in response to this kind of hard rationalism of the Enlightenment and the scientific revolution. Romanticism developed, and if you studied anything in Romanticism, you understand what that is. In the 20th century, there have been some wings of postmodernism and the left which have reacted very strongly against the dominant role of science in modern thinking. And they've done it in some pretty kooky ways, too. I remember I did one of my shows on that a couple years ago about some of the kooky things these radical anti-science people did. So I guess the question I want to ask is, How do we strike a right balance here? I mean, only a blind fool is going to deny the incredible gains and insights into our world that science has given us in most every area of life, gains that have been turned into technology that have no doubt made our lives better. I mean, no question, science is a mean of understanding and controlling our world to some degree, and it's a very fruitful one. I mean, thank goodness we no longer bleed people or stick leeches on them in hopes of curing a disease. And it's nice to know, too, that they can operate us while we're in a deep sleep. I mean, it sure beats having to strap some screaming patients down while people sit on them and hold them while the doctor removes their appendix or the like. But at the same time, too, we need to be careful about how much authority we give to science. Because just because something is placed under the rubric of science doesn't mean it's true. Or does it? I mean, when something comes with the imprimatur science, does it get special deference? Should it have special deference? I think I said before, I remember getting in a discussion with someone years ago, and we were arguing about something. He says, well, it's science. The idea being, what kind of idiot are you denying something that is science? As if something is science, it's automatically given some sort of special epistemological deference over any other form of knowledge? Or should what is considered proven scientifically just like that be deemed truth, period? I mean, this is science, or science has proven it, period? How often do we hear this, or that science backs up this, or science backs up that, or this is what the science says? The implication being, well, it's got to be truth, or that there's a good chance it's true, or that certainly it has a better chance of being truth if science didn't back it up. Or even more so, what do you think when they say, well, the science doesn't prove it wrong? Wow, I mean, for many people, when science proves something wrong, well, that's it, period. It's wrong. I mean, of course, for centuries, and I've talked about this here before too, the best science proved that, you know, the best science around proved that the Earth couldn't possibly be in motion. I mean, the evidence was in so many ways overwhelming. It proved again and again that the idea of the Earth moving was wrong, and it did so for a long time. And then what do you know? But centuries of scientific proof turned out to be, well, wrong. Turned out to be wrong. Makes one wonder what other kind of scientific things that science has proven might turn out to be wrong as well. Here's a funny example. I love this. It was during the famous court case a number of years ago in the United States, and I think it presents a great example of what I want to talk about. It was during the Scopes monkey trial, as I said, and this judge made a priceless statement. This whiz kid of a judge made this priceless statement. It should have been emblazoned in bronze, but it won't. In a concurring opinion, Tennessee Supreme Court Justice Chambliss, His Honor, made the following brilliant statement. Apparently, he was quoting someone else who said the following, quote, "The theory of evolution is altogether essential to the teaching of biology. To deny the teacher of biology the use of evolution would make his teaching chaotic as an attempt to teach physics without assuming the existence of the ether." Now, folks, that's hilarious. Because by the time of that trial, the existence of the ether had pretty much been invalidated. One of the most famous experiments in history, the Michelson-Morley experiment, done at Case Western Reserve University in 1887, called into question, the serious question, the whole existence of the ether. And not too long later, Einstein gave it the death blow. Today, no one believes in it. So the point is, long-held scientific theories have been overturned. And I have no doubt that some of the sacred ones that we hold today as well, that we hold today, will be overturned as well. Now, this might come as a surprise to folks, but there is a raging debate, at least in certain parts of the scientific community, over just what is science. I've done a show on that, the whole question of what is science, true science, as opposed to pseudoscience or bad science or even no science at all. Some argue, too, that the whole purpose of science, particularly physics, is to get at the heart of reality. What is the ultimate nature of the world? That is, science is a quest for truth, the truth. And others mock that whole idea, not only as wrong-headed, but as impossible anyway. In the last century, Italian philosopher Giovanni Gentile argued, maybe I'm butchering that name, Gentile, I don't know, argued that science cannot even prove its two most foundational principles, that the objects it studies exist, and that the sensations, the initial and substantial facts of knowledge, which is immediate relation to the object, is valid. In other words, the whole point on this is that there's some very foundational philosophical questions that challenge science right out of the gate. That's why, for others, the only thing that science can do and should do is to describe reality, at least as it appears to us in our devices, and to try to predict what it will do and to harness that understanding for our own good, for the benefit of humanity. That's all it can do, because it can never get to the real root of things. Let me give you an example. I talked about my beloved iPhone, a device that would not work without quantum physics. This device uses quantum physics. The science is being harnessed. It's being used in ways to do amazing things. Now, and unless you've done some reading into it, you can't even begin to understand how much debate and confusion and mind-boggling problems are involved in quantum physics. They are some of the most crazy, wild, and speculative theories about nature and what it does at the quantum level. People don't have any idea what's going on there. Some would say, well, you know, who cares? The iPhone can guide me to the nearest pizza joint. That's all you can get out of science. That's all that matters. Don't sweat the details. And what about the GPS on my iPhone, too? It wouldn't work if it didn't take into account some of the distortion of space that's taught by general relativity. It's self-filled with many inexplicable factors, such as, what is it really? What is gravity? Why does mass bend space and time? I mean, that's a good question. Question filled with many mysteries that baffle our minds and that the greatest brains can't answer. But again, many would say, if my GPS, using general relativity, can take me 200 miles and put me within 20 feet of the nearest McDonald's, what do I care if science don't understand how gravitons or the like work? In fact, interestingly enough, this issue of quantum theory brings up a whole aspect of science that many people don't want to talk about either. And that is the politics that impact science and the, quote, truths that science teaches us. You know, it was a fascinating story about 30 years after Niels Bohr, Werner Heisenberg, and Erwin Schrödinger pretty much set the foundation of quantum physics. They, you know, though they left many gaping holes and unanswered questions, there was a graduate student named Hugh Everett at Princeton. He came up with a proposed solution to some of the problems, because there were a lot of problems with the theory, and it was known as the many worlds theory. The idea is that a possible way to explain the weird phenomenon of the quantum realm was to assume that there was a vast network of parallel universe had to exist, in each universe the various outcomes would arise. In one universe the particle did this, in one universe the particle did that, in another that, and on and on and on, as many times it was needed. I mean, it was bizarre, very bizarre. Now the problem was that the hotshot professor who oversaw Everett's doctoral dissertation, a man named John Wheeler, didn't want to tick off Niels Bohr, who didn't like Everett's theory. So Wheeler forced Everett to greatly modify his doctoral dissertation, leaving out the stuff that challenged the conventional wisdom, whatever that means in quantum physics, the conventional wisdom. And because Wheeler needed the PhD in order to get a good job in the Defense Department had offered him, Everett acquiesced and submitted a bolderized version of his theory. Not until many years later was the idea picked up again. And today, though in various incantations, it's hot. Wild and fantastically speculative, yes, but it's the in thing now, this parallel universes. But wait a minute. What was I saying here? Scientific truth being suppressed for political reasons? One man didn't want to offend a colleague? So the evidence, however compelling, was hidden? And the other scientist agreed to do it because he wanted a job? I mean, this is what we expect with politics, with congressmen and so on. But with science and scientists, the paragon of this almost machine-like objectivity and rationality? Oh, come on, please, folks. I don't even think we have a clue as to what goes on. I mean, what do you think about the science? The science that's been done by the tobacco company over the years about the effects of smoking. How do you think that science was being conducted? Look at all the scientific papers that came out, scientific now, by the industry that challenged the idea that smoking was bad for you. Hey, folks, that was science. That's with science. Sure, now that happened to be a particularly sick and evil and extreme way of doing it, but its principle, it's hard to see how any science cannot be done with a certain amount of presuppositions already in place that will impact the results. And come on, what do you think drives the science that the drug companies do? What do you think their overwhelming motive is? A search for truth, no matter where it leads? Or is it a search for whatever truths that are going to benefit the shareholders? In this context, at least, the presupposition is called the Dow Jones Industrial Average. I once heard it expressed like this, science, and this is a little bit different from that, but it's somewhat the same idea. You get a hypothesis, and your hypothesis is that the world is made of vectors. Maybe even someone has a vested interest, perhaps a financial vested interest, in the world being made of vectors. And so he hires a scientist to study the idea that the world is made of vectors. So these scientists create a machine designed to look for vectors. And what do you know? What do they find? They find vectors. Thus, the claim is made that the world is made of vectors. And now we have it proof, scientific proof, a theory that the world is made of vectors. And if you happen to have a product that you want to sell, a product that assumes the world is made of vectors, well, all the better for science, not to mention for the shareholders as well. Now, it doesn't always work that way. And that's being quite cynical, I agree. But I think it would be naive to think it doesn't to some degree. Naive to think that to some degree that scientific, to think that scientific investigation is somehow totally isolated from any political, social, philosophical, or economic factors. It's almost hard to see how it could be, how these factors don't, particularly the philosophical, don't somehow influence the scientific truths that are being discovered. Putting aside all this, there are a host of other factors that need to be addressed in trying to understand just what science does, what it is, and what it proves. In fact, back in December of 2010, The New Yorker had a fascinating article called "The Truth Wears Off." It was incredible. It was incredible. It was talking about one of the problems that was occurring with scientific investigations. And let me read you some excerpts from it, because I think it really captures a crucial point that I want to make. You know, and it was in the context they were, some experiments were being done on the effectiveness of certain drugs. And what they were discovering was that what is known as replicability, I'm butchering that word, the idea that if you do the same experiment over and over, you get the same results. And in other words, some scientist says, I'm going to mix X plus Y and I get Z. And he gets X plus Y and Z. So some other scientist comes along and does the same thing, takes X plus Y and gets Z and on, and that way you can confirm it. It's replicability. You do the same thing over and over and you get the same results. This was a foundational principle of science. Let me read you, though, some of the excerpts from this article, because I think it really, really catches something. Listen to this. As I said, they were dealing with the idea of replicability. I'm butchering that word, but anyway. But now, all sorts of well-established, multiply-confirmed findings have started to look increasingly uncertain. It's as if our facts were losing their truths. Claims that have been enshrined in textbooks are suddenly unprovable. This phenomena doesn't yet have an official name, but it's occurring in a wide range of fields. Let me read a little more. For many scientists, the effect is especially troubling because of what it exposes about the scientific process. If replication is what separates the rigor of science from the squishiness of pseudoscience, where do we put all these rigorously validated findings that can no longer be proved? In other words, they're doing the same experiments, doing the same thing, and they're coming with different conclusions. Let me read you a few more quotes from here. Many scientific theories continue to be considered true even after failing numerous experiments. Okay, and then on and on. Then it goes on, it talks about problems with it. It says such anomalies demonstrate the slipperiness of empiricism. Although many scientific ideas generating conflicting results and suffer from the fallingness of effective sizes, the falling effective sizes, they continue to get cited in textbooks and to drive standard medical practice. Why? Because these ideas seem true, because they make sense, because we can't bear to let them go. And this is why the decline effect is so troubling. And then it goes on and on and on. The decline effect is troubling because it reminds us how difficult it is to prove anything. We like to pretend that our experiments define truth for us, but that's not often the case. Just because an idea is true doesn't mean it can be proven. And just because an idea can be proved doesn't mean it's true. And then it ends, the article ends with this. When the experiments are done, we still have to choose what to believe. Wow. Wow. I mean, that's amazing to me. This is, you know, again, the New Yorker makes you wonder what proof really is. What does it mean to prove something? So even scientifically, what does it mean? Sure, science is great. Science is wonderful. Science reaps many benefits. But what something like this article shows, and what the history of science shows, and what science itself shows, is that we are fools. We are fools to assume that it has the last word on truth. The last word on what is real and what isn't, the last word on what can be and what cannot be, the last word on what could have happened and what could not have happened, and so forth. See, science is just one form of knowledge. Good form. It's very fruitful in a lot of ways, but it's a very limited form of knowledge. And it's also a very, very limited form of knowledge in what is really, I mean, let's face it, the world is a blooming, buzzing confusion. We live in a very vast and complicated and mysterious cosmos. And I tend to think that there are lots of truths out there that science cannot even come close to touching, much less explaining, you know, especially, for the lack of a better word, all the superstitions that come with it. And see, the point is, as I've been trying to say, however fruitful science is, and all the things that we can, the practical benefits we get from it, it's still filled with an awful lot of subjectivity, an awful lot of questions, an awful lot of presuppositions, an awful lot of holes that should cause us to view it with respect, and yet at the same time, not make it the last word.